One, two, three, four, five, six.
Wow, it's hot here in the Love Shack. You're listening to WGXC, Acra, Hudson, Catskill.
Most radio shows don't come with a demonstration, but most radio shows aren't Radio Wonderland.
Greatest hits.
Right, so then I take more pieces of live radio, slice them, fit them into the groove, and then in a few minutes you get something like...
Back in LA, some restrictions apply.
It's radio made completely out of radio. I'm Joshua, but you just call me Radio Wonderland.
10:30 a.m. Saturday mornings till 11.
Some restrictions apply.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Bella Janssens of Brooklyn, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to WGXC.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, January 31st. Local early morning temperatures range from 17 degrees in Medusa to 34 in Copaig. Regional average soil temperature is 34 degrees. Now, you could take all those numbers, throw them away, because I just walked outside, took an infrared thermometer reading of the road surface, came in at under 25 degrees consistently. That means any untreated surface is primed to be icy once the rain shows up. And winter weather advisories are out until 1 p.m. for the entire listening area. Icy conditions are expected, especially on bridges and sidewalks. Watch for that. If heading anywhere this morning, it could be very dangerous, and I'm seeing some schools are on delay, especially to the south. At about 6:30 a.m., looking at 511 NY, high winds are indicated on the Rip Van Winkle Bridge, and some snowy and icy conditions are approaching from the south. Speaking of which, if anybody from the Pennsylvania 511 is listening, your website is garbage, and so is its data. Now, once the ice threat ends, which, as noted by the advisories, should be around 1 p.m., after that, we expect rain and a high temperature of 38 degrees. Overnight, the rain should end as snow and temperatures drop to 27 degrees. Tomorrow will be dry and temperatures will linger around 27, 28 degrees all day long as the skies clear out and cool off. Overnight temperatures drop to 8 degrees. Watch those pipes if necessary. Sunday, we'll see a high of 28 and some new snow in the afternoon. It will continue overnight, dropping about an inch or so. Monday looks like snow transitions to rain and we get a high of 48. Sunset today will be at 4:53 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:05 a.m. Looking way up, we see X-class flare chances are at 5%. Plasma winds will be slow at 309 kilometers per second with a thin density of less than 1 proton per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently okay above 10 megahertz with an S1 level noise floor. There are no chances for aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 144. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Maker Syndicate. Everybody, be careful out there.
My name's Justin Calder of Wave Farm and WGXC. And I'm sitting here with Dr. Charles Verstraeten.
Very good. Chuck.
Well, Chuck, it's nice to meet you. You'll be giving a talk this coming Sunday at Left Bank Ciders at 4 p.m. A rock talk about the Catskills about 385 million years ago. And so we're excited to sit down with you and get a little preview. So just to start off, Give a little introduction of yourself and what you do at your current job.
Yeah. Chuck for Stratton. I have that DR dot thing in front of me, but I'm not very formal about such things. But I'm a sedimentary rock geologist. There's different types of geologists. Some of them look at volcanoes and some of them look at earthquakes, and I work with sedimentary rocks. And what I really do, we usually think of reading as, you know, scratches, some kind of shapes and things that we make that we use as codes to tell somebody else something. But I read rocks. The things that I see in rocks help me to tell different things about the world at the point where that rock, when that rock was deposited. In fact, I have a rock in my hand. You're on the radio, so you can't see it. But on this rock, there, it's reddish color. It feels a little gritty. And I see a couple squiggly lines on it. That one of them, as it goes across the rock, it gets narrower and narrower. And this, on this rock, I see the red color. I see the kind of linear feature that kind of moves around on there. The red feature that moves around on the red rock is where a plant root was from some time back in what's called the Devonian period. So the Devonian period is mostly what I do. I look at a lot of different things while as part of my work here at the New York State Museum. I look at sedimentary rocks and look to see what information I can read from them. And so that's really my job. It's to reconstruct history. A lot of it is reconstructing the history of New York and the world to some degree. From about 420 million years ago until about 380 or million years ago. That's the rocks I work in. Go ahead.
Oh, that's fascinating to be tasked with what seems like such a long period of time to us. And that's your field, that's your scope. And it's really awesome even over the radio to hear about the language of rocks, in order to read that language. And so, it's a fascinating, skill to learn. And I imagine at the talk, this coming Sunday, you'll be, illuminating some of that language to us.
Yeah, but not in too technical terms. I really think about and have the feel for whatever level people I'm talking to. I don't get too complex and stuff. More important to me is just to give people a sense of what happened to me in my mid to late 20s. When being an avant-garde jazz trombone player, and a naturalist, I got so wrapped up in learning about the rocks around that I was seeing and the fossils, and also to think like geologists do in the sense of time. This will show up in my talk. My grandma DeCoster, my mom's mom, was born in 1888. That was a long time ago. But it isn't. Catskill, only 24,000 years ago, to me only, there was a mile of ice over the top of Catskill. Glacial ice that was coming from the north and extended all the way down in New York to Long Island.
And I've even heard it, those glaciers made Long Island.
Actually, Long Island is something that's above sea level because that was the end of the big glaciers that were extending all the way from far up in the Arctic and coming all the way down. And that was the end point. That's as far as they got. And so they dumped so much gravel and sand and boulders and mud that it left behind a high area at the end of the ice before it started melting back to the north. So, yeah, I mean, one of the days that really started instigating it, I was taking a break. I had a job out in the woods in West Hurley area, and that was after I'd come to the music school that I went to in the Woodstock area. I was sitting on the bench eating my lunch, and some of my imagination just went to thinking about a couple mastodons, one of the two types of elephants that were in New York after that ice began to melt northward. And that really struck me, thinking about what New York would have been like back as the ice retreated, and animals like giant sloths and mastodons and mammoths, those are two types of elephants from then, and all these other animals, bison that had longhorns. I don't know if they've been found in New York or not, but they were throughout North America at that time. So that really had an impact on me. And then also, I went to the local library, the Woodstock Library, and found a book. The book was about the geology of the area from basically the Hudson River going west up into the Catskills and from north of Kingston, south of Saugerties, up to north of Catskill. And instead of reading something like I would do, I was a naturalist besides a musician, and I would read about biology stuff and geology stuff. But for the first time, here was a book where I could get in my car and drive even 10, 20 minutes and see what the author was talking about in the rocks, the types of rocks, the fossils that were found in the rocks. And it's like, wow. I could get in my car and just go look instead of read about something in South Africa and Arizona and Germany. So that's partly what got me so wound up. I went back to school when I was 30 to study geology, went through undergrad and then graduate school. But it was not a chore. It was great because I'd found something else that I also deeply loved doing and exploring and learning about. So,
And something else, as in something other than.
Then my music, which is still very much a part of me. I had two performances this week in Kingston with improvisational groups, musical improv groups. And so that's still very much of my life.
Nice. I mean, somehow it does seem natural to me, music and geology, both maybe are, they have their, temporal aspects. And yeah, maybe it's also just living in this area, as you were just discussing, is such a rich, both musically and geologically, it's such a rich area.
Yeah, very much.
And I think that's personally not a coincidence. And yeah, also what you were just saying, it reminds me of hearing another geologist talk about how geology is one of the most tangible sciences. Of all the hard sciences, it's one that's the most accessible. I mean, you can just go outside and observe it more readily than most other sciences, out in the wild.
And in the basic ways, most anybody already has a little sense of reading the rocks. I lead a lot of different field trips sometimes and give talks. When I'm like walking down at John Boyd Thatcher Park, west of Albany, walking down the steps, for a trail that walks along 100 feet below the cliffs, Walking down through there, there's some fossil corals on the side of the wall that they cut to have a road there in the 1800s. Anyway, walking down those steps, there's some corals in the wall, fossil corals from about 420 million years ago. And, you know, somebody who's six or seven, I ask them, well, what do those corals say about what it was like here about 420 million years ago? And what was the environment like? And they can say, oh, water. Oh, salt water. And other things. What was the climate like? And if they think about coral reefs really pretty much in the tropics, then they can already say to us it was a warm climate and that we were in, get this, in the tropics. New York was in the tropics at that time.
Yeah. Oh, well, just when you studied geology, you really fundamentally learned that about how, you're studying tectonics, right? And how all of these ecosystems and climates are constantly shifting around.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's another one of the big things that struck me in my mid to late 20s was just thinking about, I mean, New York, about 420 million years ago, was a little bit north of 30 degrees south latitude. What? The plates have moved the continents around over time. And we were in the tropics at that time.
Mm.
And not only that, the world was a greenhouse climate at that time. Like during the late part of the dinosaurs. In the Cretaceous period, much later, the first dinosaurs show up in the rocks about 230 million years ago. And again, we're talking about rocks on maybe right under the building there at the Cider place. Those rocks are about 420 million years old.
Wow.
You drive from Catskill to go out to Cairo or Accra, you know, you pass through rocks that start about 450 million years ago at first, the kind of rocks that are kind of dark brown and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you cross into 320 million years ago. And by the time you get out to Cairo, the rocks are about 385 million years old.
Wow. So they're still pretty readily visible all around us, these rocks that are evidence of this area being in the tropics.
Yeah. And of course, underneath the sea too. We were below sea level. We were below sea level. At the time of of being at Cairo, the 385 million years ago, there was a mountain belt building up in New England to the east of us. But that mountain belt extended from East Greenland all the way down to Alabama. There were a number of smaller continents, like India has collided with Southern Asia over the last 30 million years and built the big Himalaya mountain belt. Now, this is this stuff. It's so massive. It's so... wow, all this stuff happened. And it's not in our imaginations. It's not myth. You can see it in the rocks. It's recorded in the rocks. It's not just coming out of human imagination. We make interpretations, but we also, it's a science. And we learn more and more. Anyway, sideline there. But so at the time of the rocks at Cairo, like the Cairo fossil forest, that'll be a big feature of the talk on Sunday. At that time, the mountain belt was in New England and up and down north and south now. And that mountain belt was eroding away while it was rising and rising. It might have even gotten this. Well, I'll save that for Sunday. But so all this mud and sand and gravel was eroding off, and there was a seaway that in the early part of the Devonian, like the rocks you first see as you go through the road cuts, the big road cuts there on 23 going towards Cairo. At that time, there was a seaway that extended from New England on out to the Midwest. To Ohio and places like that, at least. And certainly down to the Virginias and Tennessee. By the time you get to Cairo, mud and sand and gravel has been coming in and filling up that sea. But that shallow sea on the continent, it's not ocean depths, that shallow sea on the continent extended from the Schoharie Valley all the way out to west of today's Mississippi River, out where I grew up, in Des Moines, Iowa.
Uh-huh. So you're coming full circle to the other side of the old inland sea.
Yeah. There's just so much. So anyway,
And to remind folks, we're giving a little preview of the talk that you, Dr. Chuck Verstraeten, is going to give this Sunday, February 2nd at 4 p.m. at Left Bank Ciders, talking about our local fossil forests. So maybe just give us a little preview of, what's so special about our local fossil forest?
Sure. Well, back in about 1856, I think it was 1856, someone came across a very strange object up by Gilboa. And they actually brought it all the way to Albany to the New York State Museum. At that time, the geologists and paleontologists here in Albany, that was one of the most significant places in North America for geology and paleontology. So this person brings this strange rock to Albany, and you can see that it's kind of shaped like a bulbous base that had something that went up, kind of like the base of an onion or the base of a palm tree. And that's what it was. It was not a palm tree. It was not a huge onion, but this would have been on the order of a couple feet across and a couple feet high. It's like a big bulb at the bottom, and then you would have a trunk going up. And this is a very primitive tree. That whole line of trees died away by the end of this Devonian period. But they kept finding more things, and Gilboa became the site of what was known for 100 years or more, had the oldest fossil forest in the world. And that's the way it was always known until 2009, when three of us from the museum were out looking at a quarry. I was looking for a place to lead a field trip in the fall for geologists and paleontologists coming from around New York and sometimes out of the state. But that year, the field trip was going to be in the Hudson Valley. And so I was looking for various trips, stops to show people the rocks. And that would have been along those road cuts on 23, just west of Catskill. And I also wanted to show them some of the rocks from the Catskills, because the rocks in the Catskills were not deposited within the sea, below the sea level. They were deposited above sea level on land. So much mud and sand and gravel had come into eastern New York that it started to fill it in, the seaway in from the east. Just like if you have a bit of a sinkhole in your gravel driveway. I live in the hills and we have a gravel driveway. You would take, a bucket of gravel or something like that and just throw it in and start filling it in from the side you're on of it and fill in the puddle. Well, that's what was happening to the seaway out here in eastern New York at that time. But anyway, in 2009, walking across this quarry floor, and I see some strange little thing on this floor of the quarry. It's kind of like a meandering gutter type thing that was not very deep where I saw it. It was a couple inches deep and maybe 5-6 inches wide, but something like a gutter, in not made by man. It was something that was natural. And I'm wondering, what is this? And then the other two, we start looking around, the three of us, and we find some more of them, and we start walking and following them, and we came to a place where the three gutters we were following met at a central place. And there were actually 11 of these gutters type things that went out from this one central place. And it didn't take us too long, because the other two had done a lot of investigation into the fossil plants of the Devonian. That is where 385 million years ago, roughly, plus or minus a million years, something like that, that is where a tree stood. That is where a tree stood. And we started looking around. We found some more of those kind of roots. We found some other odd things that looked like, you know, craters that would be, you know, like 2 feet across or something like that. And it's like, wow. Well, one of the things, because I'm an expert in this Devonian period, I know about the ages of the rocks, and I find volcanic ash layers, old volcanic ash layers from explosive eruptions in the Appalachian Mountains during the Devonian, where you have ash layers that are preserved in the rocks, and you can date crystals of zircon out of them, little crystals that formed down in the magma chamber below the volcano that explosively erupted out ash. So I've been involved in that. In fact, here at the museum, I have like 23 big cases just full of volcanic ashes, most of them from the Devonian period, from New York, but also down in the, as far as Virginia and West Virginia.
Wow, well, that's fascinating.
So we can date them and figure out the ages. Anyway, that was a sideline. So we find this surface. We start with brooms and rakes and stuff, and shovels, exposing the surface. And, well, there's another tree. There's another tree. Oh, there's some more trees. And eventually, the people who study the fossil plants, especially two paleobotanists, so ancient plants, they're global experts in this. One of them was from SUNY Binghamton. The other comes from Great Britain. And they came to see this. And Bill Stein, who is retired now from Binghamton, he was just so awed by the whole thing. It's the first time in his long career of studying fossil trees from the Devonian that he could stand where one tree stood and see where all the other trees, three types of trees, where they stood in this Devonian forest. He could visually in his mind picture that forest, and he'd never had that experience before.
Mm. Yeah, it sounds like transportative and magical and just very grounding with all of this. Yeah. As you said, this science that all the records are there in the rocks. Yeah. Most of the time you have to use your imagination. And here in Cairo, you can go stand on top of that old of a tree. About how old would you say that one tree was?
About 385 million years ago. The tree stumps aren't there. You just have the impressions of the roots.
Yes.
Exactly. That's what you see. I mean, they've found some fossil plants in there since the 1960s.
Wow. Well, thanks for giving a little preview of the magic that is Cairo Fossil Forest. And, if